Hi, I'm Jeremy Hobson, in for Tess Vigeland, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of July 27th, 2012. And I've got a question for you. Are you a hard worker? I ask because there are some people out there who think you're lazy.
We've taught people that it's easier to be dependent, and you're a sucker if you pound the pavement and work at one of those tough minimum wage jobs.
In other words, you're not pulling your weight. This is a global economy. Step it up. I know what you're thinking. There are a lot of people out there who work plenty hard.
They're making upwards of $160 a year, and they don't sleep at nighttime. They have significant health problems, I think. Their families suffer. It's not worth the income.
So what are you supposed to do?
Passion isn't something that comes with a job. You have to put passion into a job for a job to excite you.
Today, we've got a passion for hard work, where it comes from, where it went, and what you can do about it. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
Today, we're going to go right to the core of the American economy, and every economy, really, and every job, and every household, and every task that we do every day. I'm talking about hard work. It's what's defined this country from its birth, and it's part of what has made us stand out from the rest of the world. But if you turn on the news these days, you might hear reports that our hard work ethic is going away.
After a full day's work of picking sweet potatoes, these employees will take home at least $100 today. Certainly a lot of work, but work that farmers say normal Americans just won't do.
They want a position, not a job.
What kind of jobs are employers saying they can't fill with Americans?
Doing a lot of jobs that I think you could argue a lot of Americans wouldn't do.
So is that really true? Have we lost our hard work ethic? And how do we get it back? Today on the show, we're going to explore hard work, who does it, who doesn't, and why it's crucial to our economy and our country. We're going to start at the south end of the 110 freeway here in Southern California in the city of San Pedro. We're at a fish market, which is kind of like a huge warehouse with a great water view. There are long glass cases filled with scallops and trout and salmon. There are tourists and families lining up for trays full of fried calamari. And there are hard workers everywhere, scrubbing the floors, hauling the catch, gutting the fish, and frying it up.
I cook the fajita trays, I barbecue the fish and fry the fish, and I give out orders.
Sergio Rodriguez is just 20 years old, and he's been working here for 4 years in a job that his coworkers consider to be the hardest in the building. That's because he works all day in a small open kitchen with multiple cooks, and this is the key, a blazing hot stove.
Working in the heat, there's like 15 people in here at one time sometimes, and you bump into everybody.
Do you feel like you get paid enough to do that kind of hard work?
Yeah, I think I do. I get paid pretty good. It's...
How much?
I get paid $11.50 an hour.
So do you think that your friends in other professions doing other things understand how hard of work you have to do every day?
No, I think I got it easy.
17-year-old Elise Cadota works here during the summers. She sells fish to the customers. She says it's tiring but fun. Well, most of it.
It's usually on Sundays that I hate because we have to, like, clean everything, like, with our hands, and it's just gross because it's just dirty, and clean bathrooms and, like, do all the dirty work. That's the hardest part for me because, I don't know, I can't do that.
A lot of fish guts on the floor and stuff.
Yeah, but I'm kind of used to all the fish guts and all that, so it's not too bad in that respect.
Do you like to eat seafood?
Yeah.
Good. Well, that's
it's
good.
It's not an option.
The job that didn't look easy or particularly pleasant to us has been filled for the past 27 years by Chino Pena. He cuts the heads off of fish and scrapes off their scales. So is that hard? Do you consider that hard?
Easy.
Gross?
No.
No.
They're like anything. When you peel a chicken, you know, you never peel a chicken?
I usually don't, no. I just get the store-bought ones that are pre...
Never get a light chicken?
No.
Oh, my.
So that's it. You just cut it open, you slice it down the middle,
yeah,
and you're done.
Done.
Chino slaps 5 pounds of fish on the table in front of me, splatters a little fish blood on my shirt. So you brought one for me.
Two. If you mess it one, you get another.
If I screw it up, I get to do it for a second time. Okay. So how do I? What am I doing here?
Chino hands me a metal device that's sort of like a cheese grater.
So we're just cutting off the scales here.
Yep.
It's not the hardest thing I've ever done, but I'd probably feel differently after about 20 minutes of this, let alone 8 hours.
How many times do you have to do this in the course of a day?
A day? All day long?
Yeah. How many fish?
How many fish? No idea. You never get an idea.
100?
Maybe more.
More. Wow. Yeah. Did I do a good job?
You do beautiful, man. See that?
Beautiful isn't the word I'd use, neither is the E word, but that's exactly how the owner of the fish market, Tommy Amalfitano, describes it.
The job is easy. Scaling the fish, working hard, is just what we do. Putting up with all the other people that I have to work with around me, that's the hard part.
Well, what would you say is the hardest job in this place?
I don't consider any job hard.
You don't think any of them were hard?
Not hard, but it's hard as far as a person that's never done it before.
There'd be a lot of people who would not think that it was fun to clean a fish or scale a fish.
That's correct. A lot of people say, no way, Jose, and they run like heck.
Do you think other people, when they come in, think that it's hard?
Definitely. They all think it's hard.
Why do you think that is?
Well, because most people don't like to get their hands dirty, number one. Everybody wants to be behind a computer. I don't know how a computer is going to fillet the fish for the people. I don't know if a computer is going to tell anybody the fish is fresh. I don't know how anybody's going to cook the fish for them. I don't know how anybody, how all these guys that are computer geeks, they make a lot of money. God bless them. They don't have to work very hard. But I think we're healthier.
You think they don't have to work very hard?
I think they work hard in their field as far as mentally hard. They work a lot harder than we do.
But in terms of physical labor?
Physical labor, we work much harder.
What would you say is a comparable job to this in terms of hard work?
I just had cement laid in my house. Those guys worked hard. I've never seen anybody milk a cow, but that must be they were up in the middle of the night milking the cows. They have to feed the cows. That must be a hard job. They have to put up with the smell. I don't particularly like the smell. Just like anybody else that comes in, if they came from the farm and they said, hey, this place smells.
Smells like fish.
If I went to your farm, I would say, your farm smells. I mean, you know, just whatever you're used to having and not having, so.
How do you teach a work ethic to your employees?
The work ethic is taught by everybody in here, not just me. Because everybody has to clean fish, everybody has to sweep the floor, everybody has to wash the walls. Everybody has to do everything.
You know, when I look around here, as probably with any business that's in the food industry, there are a lot of Latinos working here. And I wonder, do you think that the work ethic is different with people with that heritage and, let's say, somebody who was raised in Kansas?
No, not necessarily. If you come here and work in this place, I don't care what nationality you are, where you come from, you're going to work. So it doesn't make any difference because we've had a lot of different people from all ethnic backgrounds, everything. You know, they work.
Final question. If I were to offer you the chance tomorrow to switch all of this and go take a high-paying lawyer job in some office building, would you take the switch?
I'd throw you out of here.
Hello.
Hi. Hi. I'm Jeremy Hobson. How are you?
Jeremy, Ashley.
Nice to meet you.
Thank you for coming. Go ahead and have a seat.
Sure, okay.
Well, now we have come to a very different place in search of hard work. It's at the other end of the 110 freeway in Sierra Madre, just north of Los Angeles. We're at a law firm called Hoffman and Andrews. Lawyers, of course, can make a lot more money for the hard work that they do, and a lot of them don't want to talk about it. We contacted several lawyers at large firms, and they were afraid to talk to us about their workloads for fear of being offloaded. But then we found Ashley Andrews, who's a partner here at Hoffman Andrews. She used to work at a big firm, putting in 12-hour days, sometimes 6 or 7 days a week. Then she decided to become her own boss, which means less money for now, but probably an easier life.
I don't think you become an attorney for the compensation. I think you are an attorney because you like the challenge and you like helping people. Quite honestly, the compensation isn't worth it.
It isn't worth it.
Correct.
Because a lot of people that work in those big firms, especially when they get right out of law school, in the major cities in this country are making upwards of $160 a year.
They're making upwards of $160 a year, and they don't sleep at nighttime. They have significant health problems, I think. Their families suffer. It's not worth the income. If you were to divide the number of hours that we work by our salary, I would think that we probably make, if not minimum wage, less than minimum wage.
Oh, come on.
Oh, it's true.
Really?
I believe so.
It's funny because parents love when their kids say that they're going to be a lawyer.
I'm sure parents do until their kids actually become an attorney and they don't see them and then they change their minds.
Get yourself outside of the legal field and look at the economy as a whole. What is a comparable field in terms of the amount of work that you have to do?
I would probably say an emergency room doctor.
Hmm.
Because you have the pace, you have the split-second decisions that you need to make, and you're dealing with very, very critical issues in people's lives where if you make a wrong decision, you can screw them up permanently.
A lot of pressure.
A lot of pressure.
If I were to offer you the opportunity right now to switch places and take a job that pays a lot less, but spend the day scaling fish at a fish market in San Pedro, would you take it?
No.
Why not?
Because it doesn't offer the intellectual challenge that brings me to work every day, that makes me wake up in the morning excited for my day, and it doesn't offer the same opportunity to take care of people, shepherd them through a very difficult place in their life, and help them.
So a few minutes ago, I mentioned the E word, easy. Well, you just heard Ashley use a more important E word when it comes to work ethic. That would be excited. More on that coming up later in the show.
Hey, my name is Mino, and I'm a food vendor in Manhattan, New York. From what I hear, people say that food vendor is not a hard job, but the honest truth is it's a very hard job, considering the fact that you have to wake up early to get the cart ready. And pushing the cart, sometimes the battery's not full, so you have to push the cart. And it usually like takes about 3 people to push like a chicken rice cart, and it could break your back pretty much. The hours run from 12 hours, but since I live in Jersey, it takes me about 14 to 15 hours a day.
My name is Charles Snipes. I've been unemployed for about 2 years now. It's a lot of work, but if you really want something, you'll go for it. It depends where your head is at. That's an individual thing. People don't know the full thing, the ramifications, and why that person is unemployed. They just usually think the negative and don't think the positive. They don't know the whole facts. The reason why I was unemployed, the job that I had, I no longer work for medical reasons. But now I'm in school to go for a career for something that I've always wanted. And I'm going to come full circle in my life.
Some people look at our high unemployment rate and say there aren't enough jobs out there. But others say there are plenty. Americans just aren't willing to do them. Which brings us to this recent segment from a Fox News special called Out of Work.
Have you looked for a job?
There's nothing out there. Nothing.
There are no jobs?
No, nothing in my field. I'm a medical assistant.
And what about going outside your field and working at a restaurant?
No, restaurant is not going to give me the money I need to stay where I am. I'll end up in a shelter working in a restaurant.
Yes, we are hiring. We need like 2 or 3 people at all the time, basically.
We're hiring for cashiers, also chefs, and prep guys.
Now, the man you hear talking to people in that clip is John Stossel. He's the host of Stossel on the Fox Business Network, and he joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jeremy.
So what made you decide to do that special?
Fox was doing an hour on unemployment, and I just couldn't figure out why we have high unemployment, but the Help Wanted Index is at an all-time high, and employers say they can't hire. So we went down to the local welfare and job center office in New York City, not far from the Fox offices. And within 2 blocks of that place, 4 staffers, 2 interns walked around for less than 2 hours just asking businesses, are you hiring? They asked 79. 40 said they were hiring. 24 said they would take people with no experience and train them, that they just wished more people would apply, that they were struggling to get workers. Now, these were mostly clothing stores and restaurants. These were minimum wage jobs. I'm not claiming these are high-skilled jobs. But that's how you get skilled and learn to show up. And people aren't applying for lots of those jobs.
So what do you take away from that people are lazy?
Well, certainly some people are lazy. I was lazy. And if you have a government that has a reasonably generous safety net and you can make as much about collecting unemployment or various welfare programs, then some people will just prefer that.
So you think that it's the government, it's not some sort of a work ethic that's instilled at a young age or throughout one's career, but that it's the government benefits that are offered by not working that make you not want to go out and really look for a job.
I think that this ethic didn't exist before there were government benefits. Before we had the big welfare state, there were mutual aid societies all over America, private, most were religious. But they knew who really needed help because they were disabled or in need in some way and who needed a kick in the ass. And you couldn't just be lazy with them.
But there are a lot of people that would disagree with you out there that would say that there are many Americans who are out of work. There aren't as many jobs as there are applicants. And so there needs to be some sort of a government safety net.
Well, I have no trouble with a government safety net if it's a limited government safety net. But what statistics that there are no jobs out there and people applying and can't find them? The Help Wanted Index is at an all-time high. A lot of those are skilled jobs, but we don't know that people are applying for these jobs. And in New York City, in my one simple test, people are not applying.
What do you think has happened then to the sort of hard work ethic that has defined America in the past?
We've taught people that in some cases it's easier to be dependent and you're a sucker if you pound the pavement and work at one of those tough minimum wage jobs. I think other evidence that there are jobs available is that immigrants are risking their lives and getting ripped off by coyotes to sneak into America illegally. They find jobs.
Just because they're willing to do things that Americans aren't?
Often.
Well, where do they get that ethic from, do you think?
They get the ethic from coming from a country where you don't have a big, fat government safety net. You either work or you don't have food.
So you think that this hard work ethic problem in the United States could be solved simply by cutting back the government safety net?
Simply is not the right word. Once you've established a government safety net, it's very hard to get rid of it. You see it in Greece where people riot if you take away even the most minor of things. People get accustomed to getting free stuff. The more you turn it over to the private sector, though, to private charities, they are much better at saying to somebody, no, we're not just going to give you a monthly check. As one guy said, yeah, I could find work in New Jersey, but I don't want to live in New Jersey, so I'm staying in a shelter in New York. If you stop offering people blanket free stuff, yeah, people will go find work.
Do you have kids?
I do.
And what do you do to them to instill a hard work ethic?
That's a good question. One is a medical student. One is starting in his first job. And both seem to work pretty hard. And why they do that when they've had a comfortable life, I'm not sure. Perhaps talking to them at the dinner table that work gives you purpose in life and work is good for you and don't count on getting money from me.
You hold back the allowance when they were growing up?
I gave them an allowance and told them if they wanted to buy stuff, they needed to budget their own money.
Well, John Stossel, host of Stossel on the Fox Business Network, whose latest book is No, They Can't, Why Government Fails But Individuals Succeed. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Giles Harrison. I'm a paparazzi photographer. I'm based in Los Angeles, California. Some people think that being a paparazzi isn't hard work, but I would say that that's not true. It's a very detailed, oriented job. There's a lot of waiting around. There's a lot of, you know, thought, a lot of skill, a lot of professionalism that has to go into it. We're not all, you know, running and gunning and running down the street, short lens flashing people. You have to be well versed in story. You have to know how to edit photos. You have to understand the marketplace. Anyone can take a picture, but to take a newsworthy photo that's sellable for a lot of money, it's hard work.
Hi, my name is Randy Stalker, and I'm working as a consultant down here doing a glass replacement at 1000 Connecticut. It's a very busy area, Washington, D.C., and I'm an iron worker by trade. I got up at 4:45. We start work at 5:30 to try and beat the heat here. We start early. We're working 10-hour days in this heat, and it's hard work. We're drinking lots of fluids, and the main objective is not have anybody have any heat strokes here. I think we're classified as the fourth most dangerous trade in the world. We're working on heights. This particular job site, we're lifting or we're hoisting heavy glass. We work hard.
Deo, Deo, be like come and me one go.
Okay, so we work hard, but where did that work ethic come from? Did Thomas Jefferson refuse to take lunch breaks? Was Julius Caesar the last guy to leave the Senate on Friday night? For a history lesson, let's bring in Roger Hill. He's a professor at the University of Georgia Athens School of Workforce Education, Leadership, and Social Foundations. Professor Hill, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Well, set the scene for us. If you were to rank our current work ethic in America based on a 1 to 10 scale, where 10 were the moments in our history where we worked the hardest and 1 were the moments in our history when we were the laziest, where would we be right now?
I would say probably we're still, you know, somewhere around an 8 or a 9 today.
Not bad.
Overall. Not bad. But the difference is the nature of the work. Usually when we think about work in the Western part of the world, which includes the United States, we go back actually to the time of the Hebrews. And at that period of time, work was primarily regarded as a curse. The Greeks also had poor attitudes about work. Work was not something someone would espouse to do. Those kinds of attitudes continued into the medieval period. In the 1500s, a significant shift occurred in attitude as a result of something called the Protestant Reformation. It suddenly became okay for you to choose an occupation rather than to do what your father did. It encouraged working hard. And also because during that period of time in religious belief systems, people were looking to give evidence that they were one of the, quote, elect, the elect being someone that God had chosen to go to heaven. And the way that you could give evidence of that would be to be successful in life.
Well, what was it about that religious element in the United States that set us apart from the rest of the world right at our founding in terms of work ethic?
The crux of it was the work ethic or the Protestant ethic. People were motivated to try to be successful. And the way to do that oftentimes was to work hard and to apply themselves to their jobs, their occupations, and those sorts of things.
Does a society's work ethic dictate its success?
Max Weber would say so. He was an economist back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and he actually did studies of countries that were capitalist, that had built their economy on this Protestant ethic I talked to you about. And he compared those countries to other countries that were not predominantly Protestant. What he saw was a difference in economic well-being and productivity and things of that nature. He called it the Protestant ethic, and that basically the difference, I think, is those attitudes have become more secularized, and we don't necessarily associate work ethic with a religious belief system.
But they are.
The roots are there, yes, very much so, and in particular in the U.S.
So given all the history that you know, what should we be doing right now to make sure that we're working the perfect amount? I don't want to say the most, because a lot of people would argue that we're working too much. Some would argue we're working too little. But what should we be doing to make sure we're working the perfect amount?
Well, I think the key thing is to have balance in our work life, to put some limits around it. There also are some attributes that I think are important. When I look at work ethic, for example, I define that functionally as comprised of dependability, initiative, and interpersonal skills. Those characteristics are ones that are important in the workplace, and they contribute to success in the workplace. So when we think about balance and being prepared for work, I think that people who are able to successfully embrace dependability, initiative, and interpersonal skills can be successful in a more efficient way than perhaps those that have some gaps in those areas.
Now, I want to be careful when I ask you this next question because I don't want to paint with too broad a brush. But overall, when you look at the world, it seems like in a lot of countries, in the northern parts of the country, people tend to work a little harder. And when you get down into the south towards the beach, there's a little more of a laid-back attitude. Is there anything to that, or is that just a coincidence that it seems that way?
Well, because of my accent, you can tell I'm definitely from the north. And so I certainly don't have any bias. But what that's about is that the people in the South are so much more efficient in their work that they're able to get things done and get out there on the beach, whereas those in the North might take a little bit longer to get the job done.
Well, Roger Hill, professor of workforce education at the University of Georgia, thanks so much for talking with us.
You're very welcome. It's good to talk with you.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
You've probably heard it's a lot easier to learn stuff when you're a little kid. That's true for languages. And according to some experts, it's also true for a hard work ethic. Dr. Jerry Weichman is an adolescent psychologist at the Hoag Neurosciences Institute in Newport Beach, California. And he's with us now. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's start with the premise here. Is a hard work ethic a learned behavior?
I absolutely do think that it is a learned behavior. Some people are the hard chargers. You see the kids in the front of the class that are, you know, keying in on the teachers, and they consistently keep that going through elementary, middle, and high school. Some don't, and I think those can be taught how to persevere and to have really good work ethic in life.
All right. Well, how do you do that? I mean, does it matter when you start teaching your kid a hard work ethic?
Absolutely. I think it starts as early as, you know, they can understand the conversation. I think it's really important for parents not to give their kids everything that they want, to make them earn it, working to do chores for allowance and teaching them how to save for what they want. There's way too many parents out there that are just giving their kids everything, and that actually diminishes your work ethic if it's just given to you.
Do you want to start that kind of thing right at age one or two, or do you wait until the kid is 5 or 6 years old?
Well, for the allowance, you can wait until they're older. But I also think that, you know, another factor that goes into it for even the younger ones is to work before you play. You know, I work primarily with teens and preteens that are 11 to 18, and the majority of, you know, academic loss of drive comes from them procrastinating and trying to do what's enjoyable rather than what they need to do and then rewarding themselves afterwards. You can start that at an early age, and if you cultivate that, I mean, that's obviously what we all need as adults to be successful, is that delayed instant gratification.
Well, let's get specific here. When you talk about chores, what are you talking about? What should parents be having their kids do?
Things like taking the trash out, cleaning up from dinner, setting up for dinner, taking the dog for a walk, picking up after the dog, these types of things. Take all those chores, divide them in by the number of kids that they have, and every week you have a rotating weekly chore chart where the chores switch. This makes it more communal, and I think chores are important because not only are these skills that they're going to need for life, but it teaches them how to give back to the family unit rather than continually taking from it.
Well, what do you make of the situation right now? Do you think that kids have lost their drive to work hard?
You know, I really don't. I think that this new generation of teens is coming through is a very motivated generation. You know, I call them Generation M, the multimedia hungry multitaskers. You know, these are the kids that can, you know, be doing homework while downloading stuff on iTunes, while working on a Word document and texting somebody at the same time. I think that this generation is hungry, and I think they're going to be able to be really successful down the line.
But a lot of people look at that, and they see these kids tweeting and texting and playing video games and all that, and they think, we are in big trouble.
Yeah, you know, and there are those teens that fall prey to that. Their intention is completely taken away from what they want. But if you go back to working before you play, even those teens, if they put all the electronics in you and plug them for a little bit to focus on getting their stuff done and reward them afterwards, can be really successful as well.
Now, let me just push back against you a little on a personal level here. I mean, I consider myself a hard worker. I get up at 3:45 in the morning. I work long hours. But I didn't grow up doing chores. I didn't really have an allowance. I just happened to come from a big family, I guess, and felt that I needed to fend for myself in a way. What do you make of that circumstance?
Well, I think that goes back to what I was talking about earlier, is if everything's not handed to you, you do feel a need in a sense that you've got to go out there and get after it for yourself. And I think that's part of what we need to start early, because parents need to look at this situation like, you know, their job, especially as their kids start hitting high school, is to get them ready for the real world. And it's bringing a real world mentality in so that they can go out there and thrive. One of those is not doing everything for them, really allowing them to make mistakes and to fail so that they have the initiative and the drive within them to go out there and want to do it for themselves.
Now, what about you? You've got a pretty interesting story. You earned a PhD at age 26. How did you develop your work ethic?
You know, I think everybody has to keep their eye on the prize. I knew ultimately, even from a kid, that, you know, I want to be successful in life. I don't want to be dependent on my parents. You know, I want to be able to go out there and establish myself with whatever job that I go after. And I think it's really important for people to have perseverance, to be that emotional and mental fighter. When life gets tough, you get tougher, because there's a lot of adversity in life. And if you've got that kind of mental attitude, it helps you really overcome a lot.
Well, and you've dealt with some adversity yourself.
Absolutely. When I was born, I had to have my right foot amputated, so I learned to walk with a prosthetic leg. Dealt with a lot of social adversity with kids teasing early on. Fortunately, I was blessed with athletic ability and went on to play Division I football. And, you know, now I'm, you know, training for triathlons.
Wow.
And things like this. But life gives you whatever you're going to get. And it's really how you react and respond to it that makes all the difference.
Dr. Jerry Weichmann is an adolescent psychologist with the Hoge Neurosciences Institute. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And it is time now for your letters. Patty Hirsch, our senior producer, is with me to dip into the mailbag. How are you doing, Patty?
I'm well, thanks, Jeremy. How are you?
I'm doing well. So what's in the mailbag?
Well, firstly, a great deal of response to our interview of Olympian Jamie Nieto. Jamie talked to us about the cost of being an aspiring Olympian and the sacrifices that these athletes have to make.
Which is pretty considerable, I imagine.
Right, especially for a 30-something man with a family to support. Anyway, a lot of listeners wrote in to complain about Nieto. They said he was delusional in comparing himself to a professional football and baseball player, and that he didn't have the Olympic spirit. One listener, Linnea Linton of Arden, North Carolina, said he could do with a good dose of gratitude and humility.
Wow, that sounds pretty harsh.
Yeah, right. Well, the conversation is actually ongoing on our website, so listeners can feel free to pitch in on that one if they feel moved to do so.
And I saw we got a lot of mail about credit reports and credit scores.
Yeah, this is following the interview with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau Chief Richard Cordray. He suggested everybody check their credit report every year, and a commentator mentioned that that service is available for free. But we had a number of listeners who had problems with that. There was Meredith Leventhal of Baltimore, Wayne Schmidt of Seattle, and Sarah Hussein of Arlington.
And I assume these are people who went to freecreditreport.com or something?
Some did, yes.
Only to find out, I'm sure, that at that website, you don't actually get a free credit report.
No, it is probably the greatest feat of marketing misdirection ever. Other people actually went direct to the credit report bureau's websites themselves, but there's really only one site that can give you access to free reports, and that is
annualcreditreport.com.
That's right, annualcreditreport.com. You can get one copy of your report from—
Should we be singing that?
No, we should not be singing that. You can get one copy of a report from TransUnion, Equifax, and Experian every year through that site. And basically, annualcreditreport.com is a gateway to the bureau sites, right? You've got to go through it to get your annual freebie from each one of those sites. You're directed to the individual bureau site, ask some identifying questions, after which you get the report for free. And I know this works. I know some people have problems with this, but I know it works because I actually did it this week.
I thought you were going to say because you're a spokesman for the company.
No.
Okay. Well, how are you looking on your credit?
I'm pretty clean, actually. I feel pretty good about it. But, you know, B. Nichols of Birmingham asked what you should do if you go on there and you find incorrect information. When that happens, you've got to correct it via a complaint form on the individual bureau site. You can't do it at any other place, which means that you've got to join the credit bureau's sites first, which is a pain, but thereafter you're in email mode until it's fixed.
The problem is, of course, that you can't check if it's fixed without paying for the report.
Without paying for a subsequent report, right. So for the next 12 months, you're out of luck. That's right. So
some people might call that a scam or something
like that. You might call it a scam, but it's just a great business model, right? That's what Richard Cordray had to say about it. And let's hope he and his agency can do something about that kind of thing.
Well, so we'll have that information about annualcreditreport.com on our website, marketplace.org. Meanwhile, please keep writing in with your questions via Facebook, via Twitter. We're at MarketplaceAPM and on our website, marketplace.org. Patty, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, well, back to hard work. Now, what are we doing all of this hard work for? If it's not because we love it, it could be because we've got a goal in mind, say retirement. But commentator Teresa Ghilarducci says without government intervention, all our labors could be for nothing.
For most Americans, the point of a lifetime of hard work is the choice to retire. And for more than 30 years, we've seen the 401k system as a means to that end. But after this generation-long experiment, it's obvious a new retirement savings model is necessary. The case against the current system starts with horrific statistics about the vulnerability of soon-to-be retirees. 75% of Americans nearing retirement age in 2010 had less than $30,000 in their retirement accounts. This means almost half of middle-class workers will be poor or near poor in retirement, living on a food budget of about $5 a day. Our do-it-yourself pension system has failed. Few realize that to maintain our living standards into our old age, we need roughly 20 times our annual income in financial wealth. If you're earning $100,000 the day you retire, you will need about $2 million above and beyond what you receive from Social Security to maintain the lifestyle you are used to. That number may sound exaggerated, but people underestimate the high risks and the high cost of aging. Consider this. If you start saving for retirement at age 25, you'll need to hold on to 7 cents of every dollar you earn, and your investments will need to earn 3% after inflation and fees if you hope to get to that magic number. If you didn't start saving until you were 55, you'll need to keep 30 cents of every dollar, and you might make it. Scared? Good. We need that fear to motivate us to get real. The coming retirement income security crisis was not caused by a set of isolated individual behaviors. The system was simply never realistic. We need government-mandated, guaranteed retirement accounts on top of Social Security. These would be professionally managed with a guaranteed rate of return and paid out as annuities. This is a sensible way to get an aging society prepared for the future. Afraid of mandates? For most, the alternative to a mandated retirement plan is much scarier.
Teresa Ghilarducci is the Bernard Schwartz Professor of Economics at the New School for Social Research in New York City.
Hi, my name is Elmer Pineda. I work at the Santa Monica Pier Arcade. I'm an arcade operator. Some people think my job is easy, but in reality, it's not. We deal with difficult people. We clean the messes that people make, mop, sweep, work on machines that cause problems. You know, it's not easy. It might look easy, but, you know, we work as hard as we can, and it's as any other job. It's the same thing as other jobs.
My name is Earl Blumenauer. I represent Oregon in the United States Congress. My day starts every day by 6, bike to work, into the gym, but I always run with the dictating unit, and the day ends when it ends. I have no control over the schedule, and last night we were on the floor after 9 o'clock making a presentation. And then it's just the time to decompress so that your brain isn't jelly. I think you need to start and end each day with that reflection, because otherwise you will go numb. It all is a blur, and you will end a day never quite knowing what you've done, other than having met a couple hundred people, given a dozen speeches and presentations, and sat through seemingly endless meetings.
So we've heard that we're not working hard enough. We've heard why we should make little kids work harder. We've heard about our shared history of hard work. But forget all that for a second. What if we've got this all wrong? Maybe we're working too hard, and what we could really use is a vacation.
Sally Herships has that part of the story.
So how hard do Americans work? I took a walk through New York City's Grand Central Station and asked some people.
What's a typical work day for you from like what time to what time?
I get up at 6 and I check email for a few hours and then work until about 6 and then maybe an hour at home when I'm...
So hold on a second. Can you add that up for me? How many hours are you working?
I don't know. I don't want to add it up.
And so do you feel like you get enough vacation?
No, we get no vacation here. In the past, I have worked Christmas Eve, Easter, Thanksgiving. I can't even remember it. It's just I'm pretty much here all the time.
Everyone I spoke to had the same story. We work lots and lots of hours and get very little vacation. So does anyone get enough vacation? Oh, right. The Europeans. I asked some of my European Facebook friends how much vacation time they get. There's the Spanish. They get about...
It's 22 days per year.
Not including more time for holidays like Christmas. The Germans...
And at my current job as a research scientist, we get 30 days of vacation time.
That's 1 month. Then there are the Italians.
5 weeks. I mean, the average vacation time in Italy is 5 weeks.
Then the French.
Then I get 9 weeks of vacation, not including holidays. Au revoir.
The Austrian contact I had was, ironically, on vacation. If you're feeling envious right about now, you might be interested in an organization called Take Back Your Time. It's a policy group fighting American overwork. John DeGraff is the executive director.
You know, I guess the first question is, do Americans work too hard?
I don't know about too hard. Yeah, I think they work too hard, too, but I certainly think they work too much.
In 2009, DeGraff introduced a bill, the Paid Vacation Act. It would have made paid vacation required under federal law, but it didn't go over so well.
You would have thought that we were calling for the end of Western civilization as we know it.
The bill died in Congress not long after it was introduced. DeGraff says the average American works between 200 and 400 hours more every year than the average Western European. You'd think that would make us more productive, but it doesn't.
Because every business seems to think that its short-term profits come from working people as hard and intensely as possible.
But working people too hard can create big problems. DeGraff says the more hours we work, the less time we have to relax, pet the dog, exercise, and spend time with our friends and families. He says all that affects our health. He notes Americans are almost twice as likely to get heart disease, high blood pressure, and cancer than Western Europeans, which is expensive for companies because the cost of healthcare in the U.S. is so high.
But it's also higher because their workers are less healthy.
Which perpetuates a problematic cycle. High healthcare costs encourage companies to ask fewer workers to do more work, meaning less free time. Remember I said earlier, everyone I met in Grand Central told me they didn't get enough vacation? Well, it wasn't quite true. New Yorker Cecilia Acevedo says she gets enough time off.
I actually do, only because I'm a registered nurse and I'm a per diem nurse. So I work and I play at the same time.
Acevedo says she's already been on 2 vacations this year to the Dominican Republic.
And then do you also get benefits?
That's the problem. I don't. I have no insurance and I'm 65 years old.
So she told me next month she's starting a new full-time job with benefits. Hopefully it'll have enough vacation to let her take the third holiday she's already planned for this year. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
And now is the part of the show where we're going to help you help yourself. And to do that, we're going to talk to a motivational speaker. Now, when I think of a motivational speaker, I think of the late Chris Farley playing one on Saturday Night Live.
Now, you kids are probably saying to yourselves, hey, I'm going to go out and I'm going to get the world by the tail and wrap it around and pull it down and put it in my pocket. Well, I'm here to tell you that you're probably going to find out as you go out there that you're not going to amount to jack squat.
Hopefully our motivational speaker will be a little more uplifting. He's a guy named Eric Chester, and he's written a book called Reviving Work Ethic, and he joins us from Denver. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jeremy. Thanks for having me.
Well, okay, so first of all, are we lazy? Is something wrong with us? Have we lost our hard work ethic, do you think?
A lot of people look at work as a four-letter word. They want to do anything in the world to avoid work because for them, work is just something that enables them to get stuff. And as long as work is viewed in that context, then it becomes something you try to avoid.
So you're saying you got a problem if you work just to get to retirement or something like that? Just
yeah,
seeing
the end goal. And there are people, Jeremy, in every profession, every career, and every walk of life that are looking and just counting down the days to retirement. You know, you look on the one of the paradigms I draw is basically looking at this, the game of life by what used to be a Milton Bradley game. Now it's a Hasbro game, and how that has evolved over the past 152 years. It was invented in 1860 by Milton Bradley as a way to teach young people that character, hard work, sacrifice, and ambition led to success, that you didn't have to be born into wealth, that you could pick yourself up by your bootstraps and you could make a future for yourself. Well, that game has evolved so much. If you went to your local toy retailer today and bought the game of life, look at the object of the game. On the box, it says, to do whatever it takes to retire in style with the most wealth at the end of the game. You know, over the past several generations, they've put in cards where you're able to take another player's cash windfall or make another player pay a portion of your taxes for him. The latest version, which can be played online, even allows you to sue a competitor. And so, you know, the whole game of life has changed. And I'm not just talking about the board game. We've seen that change. But how is that indicative of how we live our lives? And if that becomes the object of the game that we're playing, to get a whole lot and not have to do a whole lot, then really we've lost our way in this thing called work ethic. You know, you can buy happiness. You find $100, you're happy. The question is, if you find $100, are you proud? I mean, in that moment. And the answer is no. Why? Because you didn't do anything.
Okay. So what about the person who is 45? They've been working in a job that they kind of like, kind of don't like for, you know, many, many years. And they're working toward retirement. They can see the goal ahead of them, but they don't have the drive anymore. What are they supposed to do?
I hate to say there's anything wrong with that. I mean, come on. We all hit, you know, plateaus in our career where we go, you know, is this really what I set out to do?
Yeah.
And the problem is, passion isn't something that comes with a job. You have to put passion into a job for a job to excite you. And a lot of people lose their way because they stop doing their best every day. They kind of phone it in. They just go, yeah, just counting down the days to the retirement. Instead of going back and going, what drew me here? Am I giving my all? Am I giving my best? Instead of what am I getting out of this? You know, is Mr. Employer over there who's getting rich off my labor? That's the anger. That's the frustration. I'm putting in a whole lot and I'm not getting my due. Well, guess what? It's America. You don't think you don't like your deal? Find a better deal somewhere else. But if this is the job that you have, put your best into the job and the most amazing thing happens. All of a sudden the job becomes more exciting.
But Eric, don't you ever have a long day at work, get home, have to do the laundry, make dinner, you know, do some exercise, whatever? It's exhausting.
It is exhausting. And there are many parts of my job I cannot stand. Hey, I speak for free, Jeremy. What people pay me to do is fly in airplanes and stay in hotels. I'm inconvenienced, routinely have to do aspects of my job which I do not like. I don't actually enjoy writing. I don't. So you know what you do? You work. You put your best into it every day. And when you have one of those days that you just described, Jeremy, you realize, you know what? Maybe it was a few bad things that I'm choosing to focus on all day. The whole day wasn't ruined. A couple of things went wrong and I'm angry. Let it go. The beauty is you wake up tomorrow, it's a brand new day. You can continually improve yourself and improve your lot in life. The day you stop and say, nope, this is it. It's the best I can do. You become angry, disenchanted, disengaged, and you wind up in a spiral you'll never pull yourself out of.
Well, Eric Chester, author of Reviving Work Ethic, thank you so much.
You bet.
That's Marketplace Money for this week. Make sure you like us on Facebook. Next time on the show, if you have to travel on a budget, please think about the big picture.
Buying the plane ticket that's $30 cheaper, that has two stopovers. So you spend a full day traveling. You really need to decide what your time is worth to you on vacation.
Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch along with Devin Maverick Robbins and Joel Patterson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yore. I'm Jeremy Hobson. Tess Vigeland will be back next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.